Hello and welcome to Series 2 of We Make the Future, brought to you by PyTop. I'm your host, Andrew Webb, and in these audio interviews, I'll be continuing my journey exploring the future of education, making and technology. Now to launch Series 2, we have a very special episode and a very special guest. On January 23rd, we launched PyTop 4, our new modular computer, powered, like all the PyTop family, by the Raspberry Pi. And so at the end of last year, we took a pre-production unit to show the inventor and CEO of Raspberry Pi, Eben Upton, to hear his thoughts. While there, we also found time to talk about the history of home computing, the future of education, and what led Eben to design the Pi in the first place. Here he is to explain more. So Eben, can you give us, for those who don't know, a potted history of the Raspberry Pi?
Okay, so we've been doing this. So when is it? Tail end of 2018, early 2019. We've been doing this now for pretty much exactly a decade.
Right.
So we incorporated the Raspberry Pi Foundation right at the tail end of 2008. And we did that in response to a perceived decline in the number of young people who are interested in computing as an academic subject. We're a Cambridge company. A recruitment crisis at the university in Cambridge was our kind of motivating factor. That was where we first perceived a problem. That's where we had our hands on the numbers.
Right, okay.
So we could see year-on-year declines through the first part of last decade. We could see year-on-year declines of 10 to 15% in the number of people applying to study computer science at Cambridge.
Now you've looked into it, was there any particular reason for that? Was it just a blip? Or has it continued to decline? What caused it? And well done for sort of realising that and sort of doing something about it, not just thinking, next year, maybe it'll go up.
Yeah, yeah. So the hypothesis is what happened was this was a delayed action effect of the disappearance of programmable computing hardware in the home. The 1980s, we all had our BBC Micros, our Sinclair Spectrums, our Commodore 64s.
64.
Okay. You don't meet a lot of, ironically, given that the 64 was the most successful platform globally, you don't actually meet that many 64 people in the UK. They tend to be Spectrum. You meet a lot of Spectrum people, right?
Yeah.
So you've got these pieces of programmable hardware. You have them in your home, they boot into BASIC, they lure you into programming the way that I was lured into programming. And then you find yourself, you're 17, 18 years old, you think, what should I do at university? Well, I'll do this thing that I've been doing and enjoying at home. And kind of the hypothesis that the idea we came to was that the disappearance of that programmable hardware led to a delayed decline, because of course it's a pipeline, and you're putting 10-year-old kids into one end of the pipeline, and then so if you stop putting 10-year-old kids in for 8-10 years, everything's fine. The pipeline just drains down. And so what we were seeing, those machines disappeared in the early 90s, and then in the early part of the last decade, that fed through first into a decline in university applicant numbers, and then into a decline in graduates and
interesting
people you could hire in industry.
So I'm thinking, your Commodore Amigas, your Atari STs, and your early, 486s and all that kind of stuff, that didn't fill the gap left by your Spectrums and your early Commodore, your basic machines that we were
playing. They're interesting, those machines, those kind of transitional machines, the ST and the Amiga in particular.
Yeah.
They're interesting transitional machines because they are programmable, but they don't lure you into programming in the same way. The really insidious machines are things like the Super Nintendo.
Right.
You know, these machines where you might have had somebody who bought a Spectrum to play Jet Set Willy.
Classic.
And then would graduate to a Mega Drive. And so you graduated from a programmable piece of hardware to a non-programmable piece of hardware. So I was an Amiga, BBC and then Amiga.
Yep.
I got a lot of enjoyment out of programming my Amiga,
right,
but I would never have started programming in Amiga. I graduated to it from a BBC.
I agree, because I had an Amiga as well, and I went from 64 to Amiga. For me, it was Deluxe Paint.
Yes.
That lured me down that creative route.
Fantastic package.
Oh, it's brilliant.
It's amazing. You could do a lot in 32 colours, right?
You can, and that just sent me right down the creative, which ultimately led to art school. But I never got past Workbench. I did a bit of basic programming. So you saw this decline, and you're like, right, what are we going to do?
And so if your hypothesis is that the decline is caused by the disappearance of programmable hardware, the obvious thing to do is to try to build a piece of programmable hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And really, Raspberry Pi came out of that, the attempt to test that hypothesis and the attempt to build a piece of hardware which is programmable,
mm-hmm,
which is fun. We never wanted to build a worthy platform, something which was good for you. We wanted to build a platform which was fun to use and could make its way into children's lives for other reasons, but which happened to be programmable, just like the machines in the 80s. We wanted to have something which was physically robust, because having the child own the hardware is quite important to our model. So you wanted something who could go in and out of a school bag a lot. And then finally, we wanted something which was affordable. And that was probably, yeah, that's where most of the challenges. I think all four of them had challenges. I think probably the cost was probably the one that threw up the most challenges for us.
And did you start with a figure in mind? Was it like, we've got to make this $35?
Yeah. $25. $25. We were kind of an interesting organisation. We are the $25 computer company, even though most of the computers we sell are these $35 computers. It's always been the $25 that's been out. And of course, we've just launched the Pi 3A Plus at $25. It's always been important to us to have something at that price point. Why $25? Because that was our idea of what school textbooks cost.
Ah, right.
Yeah. And you've got this idea that, you're going to ask a child to buy a special thing. What other special things are children asked to buy? Well, schools often ask children to buy textbooks or parents to buy textbooks for children. It's cheap enough most parents can afford it. It's cheap enough that when you have parents who can't afford it, you can afford to subsidize them. And so we always thought, well, look, if we can build a programmable computer for the price of a school textbook, then we have a good chance of price not being a barrier to access.
Okay. So education was always at the heart of it.
Absolutely.
So how have you dealt with the fact that, or have you segmented it so that the maker movement can take it and do things with it, or hobbyists, because, you know, you've got this classic thing where it's designed for school kids, but actually, a bit like Lego, you've got AFLs, right? You've got kind of, adult Raspberry Pi hands. Yes.
So I think what we've discovered is that so far we've been actually very lucky. With only a couple of exceptions, we've been able to pursue a kind of a Henry Ford kind of model. We make one product. And the things that make it better for education are the same things that make it better for hobbyists, are the same things that make it better for industrial users, of course, who make up probably half our customer base now.
Interesting. I'm just trying to get to a sense of what the educational needs are. Because it's incredible that you've got this thing that can meet both educational needs and then industrial needs, and you can put them in lifts, and your own office meeting rooms have Raspberry Pis to room is booked.
One of the things that we find exciting about the industrial applications of Raspberry Pi is often they're bottom-up innovation. I have some meeting rooms and I need to build a booking system for them. Well, maybe I could build it myself. Maybe somebody else on the web that's one of the reasons why volume is important. Mm. Maybe somebody else on the web has already solved this problem and put the code for it on GitHub.
Yeah.
But I guess I guess it shouldn't be surprising that one platform has served a lot of people, because, of course, if you go and look at the PC, we see ourselves as a PC company. You know, we make PCs. You know, they are low cost, they're relatively low performance, but they are PCs. Mm. And for a lot of users, they're perfectly adequate PCs.
Do those two communities mix at all? How linked is the industrial clients and the educational clients? Is there any and the makers between them, perhaps?
Well, I think it's makers between them. So I think what you find is you have hobbyists are parents and hobbyists are professional engineers. So when we look back at 2012, where we sold 1 million units largely to hobbyists at the time, that was a bit disquieting for a group of people who wanted to get these into the hands of kids.
Yeah.
It was a bit disquieting to have sold primarily to adult technically literate hobbyists.
Yeah. You said disquieting. Let me drill into that. I mean, were you worried? Did you have a...
Yeah, absolutely we were worried. You know, we want to sell it to kids, and then you look at your demographic, and the demographic is people already know about computers. So how are you going to achieve your mission? What we hadn't appreciated is those would be the people who would take Raspberry Pi into the classroom or take it into the after-school club or take it to their own kids.
Yeah.
Some of the most heartening stuff we see about Raspberry Pi is people saying, you know, I'm a professional engineer and this is the first time I've been able to really show my child what it is I do and talk to my child about my job, because it's an approachable platform for doing engineering.
So what are we at now? Like, you've got a plaque out there that's sort of 5 million units, must be way past that, about 16?
23.
23, okay.
23.
23 million units.
Yeah.
And just give me a sense of, you know, the roadmap now. Are you where you want to be?
I think we're never where we want to be. So give you an idea of where are we relative to where we started. So Raspberry Pi 3B Plus, which we ship, has four times as much memory as the original product. It has about 14 or 15 times as much multi-threaded processing power as the original product. It has networking, wired networking, which is three times the speed. It has wireless networking, which your original product lacked.
Yeah.
So we've kind of come up a long way. I think we've been pretty clear that the 3 plus generation is kind of the end of an era to some extent. That it's whatever comes next will have to be a little more discontinuous. We're at a point where we can't squeeze any more performance out of the process node that we're on. So we'll need to move to a new, smaller silicon geometry in our core processor, and that means that the step from 3 plus to whatever comes next is much larger than any of the steps that we've taken along the way from 1 to 1 plus to 2 to 3 to 3 plus.
So it's a leap rather than a
step. It's a leap rather than a step, with the sort of attendant expectation of a longer delay between this product and the next.
So when I asked around the office if anyone had any questions for you, there were a few a few points. The tech team were like, more RAM. I was like, okay, whatever. We had some thoughts from the product team, though, that was, how do you set about designing and testing these things and your whole kind of research? But just talk about how you iterated this and how you built it to this spec and that sort of stuff.
It's funny, I've never felt that we've had any choice about what we do. I haven't. I mean, I sort of feel that at any given time there was one product we could have built.
A Hobson's choice.
Absolutely. You know, it's. But anyway, so we've always felt there's kind of Hobson's choice, that there's an obvious thing to do next. You know, you're doing Pi 1.
Yeah.
So what's the obvious thing to do? Well, tidy up the form factor. You know, there was our only real significant form factor change to date has been this move from the original Raspberry Pi to Raspberry Pi B Plus.
Yeah.
The 1 Plus product, which we still have with the 4 USBs.
Yeah.
So sort of tidy up our form factor, tidy up our power. Sourcing round the corners off the board, put 4 mounting holes on. So there was sort of a tidy up step that we could do, and we did. At the same time, we were developing silicon for Raspberry Pi 2, and so the obvious thing, you know, it moved to a more modern CPU architecture, to move from single core to multi core. Mm-hmm. Then the same thing, but moved to an even more modern architecture and 64 bit with Raspberry Pi 3, and then Raspberry Pi 3 Plus, which is kind of a similar exercise to Raspberry Pi 1 Plus, which is after a couple of years in the market, see what you learned. People wanted faster wireless networking, faster wired networking, a little bit more CPU performance, so kind of better thermals. Yeah. So there's always kind of, and then, you know, we know what we need to do next, but we just know it's going to be very hard. So it doesn't feel, it's never, once we set ourselves the kind of basic functionality of the device, that it's a PC mainboard. Mm. So it's got a processor, a memory, and some I/O. And we set the price point. It's never really felt like there's been much choice.
Yeah.
Right? And you see the same thing with Zero, you know. Mm. You know, we set a price point, you know, what can we, you know, with the price point kind of drives the size, and then what can you fit in the size, and then having done that, well, what's missing? Wireless networking, let's do Zero W. Mm. So there's kind of all of these things. I'm sure there are many, many things we can do, but from kind of the trench that we're in, the furrow that we're ploughing, always feels like it goes to an obvious place next.
Does that give you a sense of, I imagine, a sense of purity, you know, that you cannot deviate too much, you cannot get sidetracked, you cannot lose or do the Raspberry Pi equivalent of the Newton or something like that? You end up like in cul-de-sacs and spreading yourself too thin.
Yeah, I think it can be good and bad. It's good because it cuts down on, we don't really ever have any churn. There's never really a point where we kind of get a product close to launch and then say, no, we don't like this, and then go do something else. Mm. And that's, churn can be very, certainly as from the engineering bits of my career, churn can be very demoralizing, right? You know, you put your heart and soul into something and it doesn't see light of day. So that's been good. I mean, obviously it does run the risk that we miss some next big thing, but I'm sure we'll get onto this. So that's one of the many benefits we get from the ecosystem. I think we've been lucky that we haven't tried to take all of the value. You know, we've left very large bits of real estate unexplored, and ecosystem partners, either existing companies or new companies that have grown up entirely around the Pi, have emerged to fill those niches that we're not in.
I really want to talk about that, because obviously PiTop couldn't exist without the Raspberry Pi. Yeah. I mean, was that a deliberate thing to say, right, we'll build this central thing and then we'll have this sort of ecosystem grow up around it? And we're not just talking about knockoff iPhone cases from China as an ecosystem. Yeah. We're talking about dedicated partners who have got significant roadmaps and investment and that. How did you arrive at that sweet spot where it's just enough to encourage innovation without killing it?
Necessity in the first instance.
Excellent.
We just didn't have the people. And then by the time we had maybe some more people, I mean, we still have.
So it's quite serendipitous.
Yeah, that's it. It's very serendipitous. We still don't have enough people, because you think how big the community is, how big the commercial community around Raspberry Pi is, thousands of engineers, right? And so we don't have thousands of engineers. So there's no way, even if we wanted to go do everything the ecosystem does, we couldn't do it anyway.
Yeah.
But the point was, by the time we were of a size to do even anything outside of the core product, we become aware of the advantages of the ecosystem. We make a plastic case for the Raspberry Pi. You would not believe the debate that went on about that plastic case, because of course there were ecosystem players who grew up on making plastic cases.
Yeah.
You know, there's, I mean, obviously, I guess Jacob Mod My Pie is the most obvious example on the injection molding side, and then Pimeroni on the laser cut side.
Mm.
And there was a lot of debate of, are we eating our ecosystem partners' lunch? And what we did was, in the end, we looked around and we saw that kind of all those people had moved on.
Right.
Really, the case had been the first kick of capital. These kind of organically grown companies had been the first kick of capital that got them going, but they'd moved on to other bigger things. And
right.
So I felt like, a good example, why don't we do a audio DAC accessory for the Pi? And the one reason we stay out of that is there are companies that do that, and that would be eating some, and that's their thing, and it's currently their thing, and it would be eating their lunch if we went and tried to make something. I'm sure we could make a great audio DAC, but all we'd accomplish would be to kill a bit of ecosystem for no good reason. So the plastic case in the end, why did we do the plastic case? We did it because we saw that people had moved on. There weren't cases that we felt expressed our brand ethos and were affordable. So there were cheap cases and there were good cases, but there were no good cheap cases. So occasionally we've intervened there. Same with the Sense hats, another good example, where there wasn't quite that. There were a number of accessories, but there wasn't anything which was kind of the killer accessory that we felt we could recommend in our teaching material. So we end up building the Sense hat. There has to be a lot of market failure before we'll intervene, because we know that it can be damaging to people.
I was at a school in Kingston yesterday, and they've got obviously Raspberry Pis, they've got Pi Tops, they've got Arduinos, they've got Lego Mindstorms. The teacher said to me, they're at the coalface of this, and this is quite a good school. He talked passionately about the community and the support that you can get, and that's, if you're struggling, someone out there will have fixed it. I mean, how important was the community play in this?
It was very important. So we announced in 2011, May of 2011, that we're going to do Raspberry Pi. We shipped our first units in March, April of 2012. So there was basically a year during which we weren't anything other than a community. You know, we were a community of people who were excited about getting Raspberry Pis long before we were people who had Raspberry Pis. And this is all down to Liz. So this is my wife, Liz, who continues to run the community and social media side of the business. I mean, she kind of invented a way of doing this, right, of going out and engaging the community and being respectful. And she's very good at building a community around it. She was very good at interacting with the press and being kind of respectful and firm, I think, with everyone she interacted with. We had the blog, we had Twitter, we had the forums. A lot of discussion about Raspberry Pi happens on our own platforms, on the forum in particular.
Yeah.
That's been very useful because we can exercise editorial control. Mm. And in particular, if you come on and you're a troll, we're going to throw you off. Mm. We probably got about 100 to between 1 and 200,000 registered users on the forum. I reckon we've banned a couple of hundred in the lifetime of the forum. But those 200 people make the difference between a respectful environment where you can turn up and ask stupid questions, you know, ask beginners, because we were all stupid once. Some of us still are stupid, but you can turn up and ask a beginner's question and be treated with respect.
Yeah.
And the cost of that is you ban 200 people. I sometimes think we have an advantage being British in that we don't come from a free speech society, right? We don't come from a country that has the freedom of speech written into its constitution.
Yeah. And we don't have a constitution.
Well, that's it. You know, we have this. Well, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, we're discovering all sorts of new bits of constitution with every passing day, right? But there isn't for us this sort of primacy of freedom of speech, and so we are able to say, well, look, We're not the government.
Yeah.
If we tell you can't come on our platform, we're not censoring you. We're just telling you that you can't come on our platform and be mean. And so what this has created is a space where people can feel safe to come and ask beginners questions. I think it's been an important thing for us.
I want to move on to the contract with the government and your work with BCS and STEM learning. Just talk to that.
Well, this is the foundation. So as I guess you know, we're a not-for-profit.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I run is Raspberry Pi Trading, which is the trading subsidiary of the foundation. We're running this big hypothesis test. So we're 10 years into testing this hypothesis that providing low-cost, high-performance computing platforms will cause more young people to be interested in computers.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing that's happened is a lot of other people noticed the same problem at the same time.
Right.
And organizations grew up in parallel with us, just as there are organizations that have grown up which are somehow descended from us, people who integrate our, organizations like PyTop that rely on our hardware. There are also a bunch of organizations that have grew up at almost exactly the same time in parallel. So, you know, Code Club, Coder Dojo. So you have all these organizations that have grown up trying to solve the same problem, and then you have government interventions as well, which are trying to solve the same problem. Yeah, it was great, right? Because we had this terrible curriculum, and now we have this great curriculum. And it's pretty clear there was a missing bit, right? That changing the curriculum isn't enough. You have to change the curriculum, and if you want to be respectful to teachers, you have to provide them with training to come across to the new curriculum. And that was for several years, that was a missing piece that was limiting the effectiveness of the new curriculum and limiting effective adoption. I mean, everyone has to adopt the curriculum, right? It's the national curriculum, but it's limiting the effective adoption of the curriculum. And so about a year ago, government announces that it's going to make some money available to address this deficit. And because there are these other organizations around, we're able to put together this nice coalition of three organizations, ourselves, STEM Learning, who are the prime, and BCS, and go out and bid for the various tranches and win them all, which was wonderful.
So what does that look like for your average teacher in, you know, Maliasa Street Comprehensive?
Right, so it looks like the opportunity to come out of school, go attend some in-person training, to access online resources that assist with professional development, and also to have access to teaching resources. So you have teacher training resources, and then you have child teaching resources, which you can use in the classroom to teach children the concepts that are required by the curriculum.
Taking you back across the 10 years that this has been going, what would you do differently, and what do you think is your greatest mistake?
Oh, what would we do differently? I wish we'd started a bit sooner. I think we could have launched Raspberry Pi a year earlier. I was doing an MBA, so I was busy. The foundation's been transformed by the arrival of Philip Colligan as chief exec. And I wish we'd known Philip in 2012. You know, that would have been good. There are always things on the technology side, there are always things that you wish, and a lot of my time now is trying to figure out what are the things that in a year's time I wish I'd done a year ago.
Right.
And then try and do them. So there are always dependencies. All this is pointing in a funny direction, right? Particularly with the government work, which is, if this has been badly broken, and if it's still broken in 5 years' time, then it was our fault. That's kind of like that's the flip side of like kicking the can down the road is fun, right? Because on some level, it postpones the moment where you look in the mirror and you've had control of so much of it for so long that there aren't any easy excuses left if it's still broken. It won't be broken in 5 years. It'll be glorious in 5 years' time. But it does focus the mind.
Well just speak to that 5-year plan. You know, so what are you seeing? The world is in some pretty crazy space right now. Yeah. What get your crystal ball out and tell us what 5 years looks like.
What's 5 years' time look like? I think we'll all still be here.
Okay. So
there's a lot of strange millenarian. I mean, I think we all fall victim, don't we, sometimes, to this kind of millenarian view that this time is different and it's the apocalypse. But I think we'll still be here. I think we'll still be making little computers, and I hope you guys will still be making your products.
Mm-hmm. But that's going to start feeding this pipeline again, right?
Well, so that's it.
Is the pipeline still 10 years' time?
No, I don't think it is, actually. I mean, I employ at least one person who came through from Raspberry Pi. You asked earlier about the numbers at Cambridge. We went from 600 applicants in 1999 down to about 200 in 2008. We had 1,100 last year.
Okay.
So the pipeline, you're seeing the Code Club, which is 9 to 13-year-olds. You've got 100,000 kids in the UK every week having an experience with computing in Code Club. 41% of those are girls. Mm-hmm. Similar sort of interesting statistics for Coder Dojo. So those are two organizations that started separately from Raspberry Pi, but have since become part of the Raspberry Pi family. So the leading indicators are good for numbers. The leading indicators are also good for diversity. So I think, you know, 5 years' time, you're going to start to see that wave of Raspberry Pi people propagating seriously into industry. Hopefully, you'll start to see some movement in gender diversity, at least, and hopefully socioeconomic diversity in university applications and university admissions. And I think as the years go on, we understand more about how to help teenage girls remain engaged with STEM subjects.
Do you still think university is where it's at? I'm thinking of companies like Makers Academy, who can, yeah, going to be a software developer in 12 weeks. You know, is it still the white hot area of research and development that you get at university, or is the education sector widening out so you can choose different options?
So there's a risk, right? If you have people who've just done a computer science degree, mm-hmm. or you have people who've just been to a hacking camp, that they're somehow hollow. They somehow have some deficiencies which are going to limit their effectiveness. So maybe you need to go do a computer science degree and then go to a hacking camp, go do an apprenticeship. Or maybe you need to do what I did, which was to program 2 or 3 hours a night throughout your entire childhood. Turn up at university thinking you're the king of the world, have it beaten out of you, and then learn the stuff that's missing. But I think the two are very important. I never advise anyone to not go to university to do this stuff. Although it's, you know, it's expensive. I got a free university. I got a grant in my first year.
Yeah, me too.
Little grant, but I certainly got a free university education. But even now, it's expensive. I think that although if you apply yourself, the things that you learn are worth the money, both economically and spiritually. I think, yeah, okay, it's £50,000 or something, but I think there's a lot of things you can buy for £50,000 which are worth less to you as a human being than a good university education. On a good course, at a good university, on a good course, there are the right course for you. They're two separate things, aren't they? There are bad courses. Mm-hmm. And the bad courses create a problem, right, which is that there is actually quite high unemployment for graduates of computing degrees. And that sometimes gets pointed to as evidence that we're on, what the hell are you doing? You know, if there was so much demand for this, why would there be such high unemployment? And the sad fact is that a lot of these people have been robbed.
You know,
they've been lured into inadequate courses. That claim to prepare you for life but really don't, and farmed for their £9,000 a year. And that sort of stuff is disgraceful and needs to be, yes, nothing needs to be looked at, I guess. But yeah, by and large, there's a lot of jobs out there. There's a lot of people coming in the front end of the pipeline. There are a lot of very, very high quality courses, a lot of very, very good universities. And at the end of it, there's a lot of jobs need filling. So ultimately, I think they're like the shape of the ecosystem, you know, bits of it need polishing. Mm. I think that this piece of government, these three tranches of government money, are an important part of polishing one aspect of that. I think employers actually need to look to whether they should do more.
Yes.
But by and large, the shape of the ecosystem, particularly at this time and particularly in this country, is very, very strong and very, very encouraging.
Last but not least, certainly not least in my eyes, I want to talk about PyTop 4. So at the time of recording, you've been privileged to have a sneak peek. I just wanted to get your thoughts and whether, honestly, what you think of it, yeah, and also how you see it working.
It's interesting. So I've been involved in the PyTop story basically all the way through. So I remember being at TechCrunch Disrupt. I am going to guess what year it is. It's 2014. And I was on stage with, Jesse handed me a 3D printed prototype, and I was on stage with John Biggs, and I had this thing in my hand, and it was like nothing I'd ever seen, you know, a laptop that you could hack with. What's been interesting is to watch the evolution of the product from sort of 3D printable laptop to professionalized laptop to Seed to the second generation laptop, yeah, and then now to PyTop 4. It's been interesting to watch the company kind of, I guess, sense the market. I think we've been very constrained in terms of, and so we haven't really sensed the market because we really haven't had any choice about what we build. Uh-huh. It's been great to watch a company try and do that, and each generation has addressed the challenges of the previous generation, sort of polished the value proposition. I liked it. I was completely surprised by it.
The form factor.
Yeah, the form factor. I was completely surprised by it. I think that's a good thing. And I think it's a testament to, it's the ecosystem doing what the ecosystem does, right? Which is to go and explore places that we never would have imagined. So the idea that, you know, we are particularly aware for developing world application. We're aware of cable and power management as being things that we have not historically done particularly well or done anything about, mm-hmm, and things that have been part of the PyTop value proposition. And this is another interesting, so when you take the base unit and you knock it onto the back of the keyboard and display, you're back to a laptop configuration, or you use it standalone connected to a mouse and keyboard and connected to a monitor. In all of the configurations, it takes time and complexity out of the classroom experience. I mean, I can see that device just getting everywhere, right?
It's almost exciting because we think we know how it's going to be used,
yeah,
but the fact that you can just unplug it.
Yes, and then at the end of the day, you bring it back and you plug it into your, plug it in, and that's the brain for your laptop. And so it's the ecosystem doing what the ecosystem does best, which is to go and explore and learn iteratively in areas that we have not. I'm lost. On some level, I'm lost in admiration for you guys for daring to do stuff with batteries. You know, that's
mains powered too.
Yes, but you have batteries in your product.
Yeah.
There are areas of endeavor that you guys have been involved in, so particularly around displays, keyboards, batteries. batteries, which are, I think, still, even though we've grown a lot of capability, we've gone from being able to just about make Raspberry Pi 1, which is an unintentional radiator, so we can get it through EMC, to doing Raspberry Pi 3 Plus, which is, has dual band 5 gig Wi-Fi. You know, the conformance campaign for Raspberry Pi 3 Plus cost £300,000 and took man years. We've grown a lot of capability inside the organization, but fundamentally there are areas of endeavor like that which we have not got involved in, and it's been wonderful to see an organization go do that stuff, take on those challenges and vanquish them, and then iterate around it, not just, hey, we made a laptop, we're done now, but you know, we made a laptop, what did we learn from making that laptop about what we might make next that is a laptop and that we might make next that isn't a laptop. People get obsessed when they think about companies. They think about companies in terms of their products or how they make money. And I think companies are things that make products or services and as a result of selling them make money. And that's true. But what they're really doing, what companies are really doing, is they are developing capabilities and accumulating pools of options. And then occasionally they'll exercise some of those options to create a product or service, which they then sell to get the money to go make more options.
What do you think of the OLED screen on the back?
I think it's really cute. I won't be happy until someone's written Pac-Man for it, obviously. It's crying out for some standalone applications.
Can you imagine playing Snake on it?
Yeah, it's Snake. It's got four buttons on an OLED screen. So I think it's really, you know, I mean, I obviously, you know, people have a lot of success with standalone Pi, people have a lot of success with kitted Pi, but I think there's a big niche for this one. I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes. So it's kind of the physical computing aspects of the Pi were, for me as a software engineer, almost an unexpected bonus. I originally saw this as a PC. You know, I didn't plug things into my Amiga. You know, I didn't plug LEDs into my Amiga. You could plug LEDs into your BBC, but I really didn't. So I'd seen it as a software platform, but of course it's become increasingly a physical computing platform. And so by taking the base unit and, you know, putting it in a good enclosure and providing a good power solution, and then the remote GPIO, I did love. That's a very fine pitch cable. Connecting those. It's very flexible for something that's got basically 40 conductors going down. I was speculating you might have cheaped out on grounds a little bit to get it to be more flexible. It's actually got a full complement of ground wires. But you know, I think it's great, and I think it's got its place. I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes. Brilliant. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's been a bit of a
products. Slow. 4 years, four products.
4 products. Yeah. This is the big one, though. It's going to be an evolutionary leap.
That's it. You know, you look at the trajectory of any product line, and you have some evolutionary and you have some revolutionary steps. Mm. And you know, you look at Pi, you've got kind of 1 to 1+. Evolutionary, 2 revolutionary, 3 revolutionary, 3+ evolutionary. But what we know, we'll do, whatever we do next, will end up having to be kind of necessity. Some of the revolution's forced on you, you know.
More of a spring.
Yeah. And I'm going to be interested to see which of the accessory products is the one that does the most business, right? Is it the drone? Is it the humanoid? Is it the laptop? I mean, I sort of suspect that the laptop is going to, because I think that Microsoft Surface Lite form factor is actually, independently of Pi, a very successful form factor. So having Pi in that form factor is quite attractive for me. It'd just be interesting to see which of them, or the standalone. You know, how many people are going to see this as a really good, rugged plastic case with a battery in it? That alone has great value.
If you look at, you know, most IT suites in schools, not that we just still want to be in there, but they already have keyboards, mice and screens.
Yes.
So it's a cost-saving exercise for those guys. Yeah. But it's, I think, to piece your piece about it's becoming a maker device is key, because it just widens it out. Mm. And it gets into the realm of costume design, stagecraft and theatre and all the designs. Yeah. It gets it off the screen and out of a room and into the environment. And part of this is the case is rugged enough that you can leave it on in a tree for a week.
and that's the key to that. Relevance is the key, I think, to broadening participation. There's a class of student, and I was one of them, who you can get with, hey, we're going to learn about if statements.
Yeah.
You know, I would have, you had me at if, and I'm one of those. And a lot of the people who you're surrounded with when you work in the current tech industry are those people. Yeah. Because actually it was hard to, even with these machines in the 80s, I think, well, the exciting thing is we look back at the 80s as an amazing time. It was actually a terrible time from a diversity perspective and from an accessibility perspective and a community perspective. I remember I knew one other guy who broke computers in my whole town, you know? And so, you know, we can make all these things better. And I think an important part of that is positioning computing software and hardware as a way of solving problems that you have that are not computing problems. And I want to make a fantastic clothes for a fashion show. I want to find out what's been pooing in my garden. You know, they're all of these things. And if you do that, you don't just get the 5% of kids who like if statements.
Yeah.
You get the basically all kids who have something they care about in their lives. All kids have something they want to do and they can't do. And if you get to them and you position computing as being relevant to them, then you engage people's interest and you get people to do the... It's a slog.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work to get good at anything. But that's the hope, is that you can engage people's passion and or help them through the time that it takes to get good at this stuff so that it sticks and so they stick with it. And what's the future look like? One good thing about the future, it's not going to happen in 5 years, but it might happen in 10 years or 20 years, is the engineering industry will look like society. Because it doesn't at the moment. Go and look around at any engineering firm. That's not a picture of society in any way. And I think that the leading indicators suggest, and some of the experience we're getting suggests, that we can turn the engineering industry into society. And that's incredibly exciting because it's such an enjoyable job. And we have to go out and give that opportunity to as many people as we can.
And my thanks to Eben and everybody at Raspberry Pi for finding time to talk to us. I do hope you enjoyed that. The work they're doing there is really important. It's part of the PyTop story. It's part of a wider story to get kids to solve problems using technology and creativity and not just be consumers of technology. And I think that's really, really important. If you'd like to know more about the amazing PyTop 4, and I hope you do because it's flipping awesome, as well as see our new draw-dropping promotional video, please visit pytop.com and follow the links. It's a pretty amazing piece of kit, pretty amazing video as well, actually. So do please check that out. You can do everything with this thing. It is awesome. Also, a bit of housekeeping news. We're going to take the podcast fortnightly rather than weekly this series. Hope you don't mind. This will, we hope, allow us to line up bigger guests and take more time to explore education and technology and just give me a bit more time to edit it all together, quite frankly, because there's a lot on this year with the launch of PyTop 4. Finally, remember there's 8 amazing episodes in Series 1 to listen to. If you've not already done that, they are available on all your favourite podcast apps. Just search for PyTop or We Make the Future. In the meantime, that's all from me. See you in a couple of weeks. Goodbye.